From the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week, on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, Roe takes center stage at the Supreme Court. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. This week, the Supreme Court took up the Dobbs case out of Mississippi, which prevents abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. And we had full coverage of it on Wednesday. Here's Tony Perkins.
Oral arguments, as I mentioned in the case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, were heard by the United States Supreme Court this morning, ending shortly before noon after nearly 2 hours. The court's conservative justices seem poised to uphold the Mississippi abortion law at the heart of the case, but less clear was whether or not the court might completely overturn the infamous 1973 Roe versus Wade decision that legalized abortion on demand through all 9 months of pregnancy. Now, outside, pro-lifers gathered in front of the steps of the courthouse to give a voice for the voiceless. Joining me now from the courthouse steps is Mary Sock, director of the Center for Human Dignity at the Family Research Council. Mary, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony.
So, Mary, give our listeners, our viewers, a sense of what took place earlier today as the oral arguments were underway.
As the oral arguments were underway, hundreds of pro-lifers and many pro-abortionists gathered outside the Supreme Court. On the pro-life side of the rally, there was a hopefulness in the air, that there was so much joy. It was the moment that the pro-life movement has been waiting for 49 years, a chance for America to once again defend the unborn.
Now, we were there last year, or a little over a year ago, when the court was looking at Louisiana's law on abortion clinic regulations. Was the atmosphere more positive this time, with a sense of anticipation, given the new justices that are now sitting on the court?
It certainly was. There was a palpable sense of hope, a feeling that this is the moment that America has been waiting for. This is the moment where we can finally be at the front of the world in defending the unborn, where people will finally once again have the opportunity to have a say in whether or not a baby in the womb should be killed. And this is an absolute atrocity that for 49 years in the United States, we have allowed unborn children to be brutally killed in the womb. And it's something that I think the pro-life movement felt today could come to an end.
Mary, one final question for you. As you saw the sometimes we have those competing rallies there at the front of the Supreme Court, there were those advocating for abortion under the provisions of Roe. But is your sense that as that side kind of, is it diminishing? Is there a sense of deflation among those advocating for abortion on demand?
I think there certainly was. As you mentioned, Tony, we were here for the Louisiana case, and it seemed like the other side was much more energized at that point. Today, we saw a lot of wounded people, a lot of people who were here expressing their woundedness and unable to reconcile the fact that unborn children have been killed in their mother's wombs for 49 years. I think we'll continue to see a lot of pain from the pro-abortion movement.
Mary Sock, thanks so much for joining us, and thank you for being up there representing all of us at the Supreme Court today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony.
Now I want to turn our attention to what took place inside the court and what we might expect in the days and months to come. Joining me now to talk about today's oral arguments, we're going to be joined by Sharif Gurgis. He is Associate Professor of Law at Notre Dame Law School. He served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito. We're going to be joined by him in just a moment. I think some very interesting aspects of the arguments that were taking place within the Supreme Court today. My sense in looking, I'm going to ask Sharif this, but in my sense in listening to this, is that those on the court, on the left side of the court, are struggling to try to somehow bolster Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the two cases, the two decisions that uphold abortion on demand in this country. The reason I say that, and we now have the professor. I'll go to this clip in just a moment. Professor, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Sharif, let me just ask you this. What did you think about today's oral arguments?
Well, I thought there were a lot of people who at 9:59 would have told you that there's no chance that the court overturns Roe v. Wade, who by the end of the argument would have told you that's probably the most likely outcome. The main reason is that Justice Kavanaugh is widely seen as the swing vote, and Justice Kavanaugh at every turn was suggesting that he thinks this is an issue that under the Constitution belongs to the states. The only middle ground that was discussed was by the Chief Justice, but nobody seemed to take it, and the lawyers on both sides seemed to think it was unworkable.
It did seem that there was very little from the left, other than trying to, those on the left side of the court, if you will, the liberal side, stare decisis is one of the points. The Chief Justice made reference to that, too. But it seemed like Justice Sotomayor was the one who was doing most of the talking, at least when the Mississippi was making its case. And quite frankly, I think she was reaching. One of the arguments that she used to, I don't want to play this clip if we can real quick. Clip number four, please. Play clip four.
I'm not trying to argue that we should overturn those cases. I just think you're dissimulating when you say that any ruling here wouldn't have an effect on those.
Respectfully,
that no state is going to think otherwise? That no people in the population aren't going to challenge those cases in court?
And she was making reference, Sharif, to Griswold, Lawrence, Obergefell, literally trying to tie Roe to those cases, saying, well, look, if we overturn Roe, we could lose all of these as well.
Yeah, I don't think that went anywhere, and I don't think it will go anywhere for a couple of reasons, but probably the most important one is that there's just no serious opposition from the states to those much more settled precedents. Whether they were rightly or wrongly decided in the first place, you don't see states passing laws that are trying to challenge the Griswold's rule that married couples have access to contraceptives. You don't see them even challenging Obergefell's rule that same-sex marriage has to be recognized. You certainly don't see them trying to pass anti-sodomy statutes that would challenge Lawrence versus Texas. So whereas Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey are every bit as contested as they were when they were handed down, if not more so. So there's real comparison between the two.
Yeah, and that point has kind of come across, that this has politicized the court probably more than anything, because they reached in and they grabbed this from the American people and did not allow the democratic process to reach consensus on this. And this seemed to be, and this was some of the questioning and comments made today, that there is a recognition that that's what the court did.
Yeah, I think that's a point that's especially powerful with Justice Kavanaugh. He seems to say at several points that, look, these are difficult issues. There are real competing interests on both sides. There are fair-minded people of goodwill on both sides who take a different position on what the law should be. And because it's so complicated, and because there are so many difficult moral questions at stake, and so many different ways to respond to those moral concerns, to meet the needs of women, as well as protect unborn life, that this is not something that the courts are fitted to handle. And this is something that's much better suited to the political branches, and that, as a matter of fact, our Constitution leaves it to the political branches and to the states rather than the courts.
What did you make of the conversation about science? Justice Sotomayor trying to be dismissive of the arguments that children in utero feel pain, equating that to dead people who react to stimuli. I mean, again, are they reaching to try to uphold Roe?
You know, it's interesting. It wasn't entirely clear to me exactly where she was trying to go with that line of argument. One reaction I had to it is that most pro-choice advocates today, and certainly most philosophers who argue for abortion rights or abortion access, anything like that, would tell you, well, of course, that from conception onward, what you have is a human being in the sense of a whole and complete member of the species Homo sapiens. The same thing that you have at the teenage stage and at the elderly stage is what you have at the zygote, embryo, and fetal stage. And they just disagree about the moral worth of the human being at different stages. She, at some point, seems to be veering in the direction of challenging even that scientific consensus that this is exactly the same organism. And that would seem like an unusual tack to take. It's certainly not the tack that any serious pro-choice scholars that I'm aware of today would take, because it's just a matter of science that it's a human organism from conception. And it seemed an especially unproductive way to try to push this constitutional argument along.
Right.
And I guess one thing that was striking to me is that Justice Kagan, who is normally the most incisive, one of the most incisive questioners at oral arguments, seemed
silent.
To say almost nothing.
Sharif, we're out of time. Got to leave it there.
God is the author of life and has created man in his image. Therefore, we must respect the inherent dignity of every human life from conception until natural death. That is why Family Research Council works to pass federal and state legislation that highlights this principle, including laws that protect the unborn. To keep you informed on this issue, FRC has created online maps that illustrate progress in each state on key pro-life laws. That way, you can know if your state legislators are working to protect unborn babies. The pro-life laws FRC tracks at the state level, including those addressing late-term abortions, fetal dignity, defunding abortion businesses, and providing medical care for babies born alive after an attempted abortion. Stay informed on where your state stands on pro-life legislation. Check out our pro-life maps at frc.org/pro-life maps.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So good to have you with us. Again, I want to thank all of those who participated in Giving Tuesday and partnered with FRC. We're very, very grateful. And speaking of giving, I'm going to give away one of our stand mugs, one of our stand coffee mugs. These coffee is what I put in. You can put tea in it or something else. 15 ounces made in the USA. It's a stand mug. Last week we had a text giveaway, and today I'm going to announce the winner. It's Haley from Raleigh, North Carolina. She is our stand mug winner. Haley shared that she stands for life. Life begins at conception, and abortion takes the life of an innocent human being, she said. Congrats, Haley, and stick around, because later I'm going to tell you how you can win a stand mug as well. Or you can always go to TonyPerkins.com and buy one. Make great Christmas gifts. On Monday, a Senate motion to end debate on the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act failed by a vote of 41 to 51. It required 60 votes. Five liberal lawmakers joined all Republicans who voted to reject the procedural step forward. In remarks on the Senate floor just before the vote, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, ranking member on the Senate Armed Services Committee, accused Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of trying to jam the bill through the Senate without adequate consideration.
We're in place right now because Senator Schumer won't prioritize national defense and fund our troops, because the majority leader mismanaged the Senate schedule. He won't allow votes on bipartisan amendments that make our country more secure.
Well, joining me now by phone to talk about the latest on this must-pass annual military spending bill is Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, an Army veteran and a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tony. It's good to be back on with you. Happy early Merry Christmas to you and all your listeners. Although it's never too
Absolutely.
Early to say Merry Christmas, right?
Never too early. Not around here, and you can always say Merry Christmas here. Senator, before I get into the NDAA, I want to ask your thoughts. I want you to put your lawyer hat on for a moment and give us your thoughts on the oral arguments today that were heard by the Supreme Court in the Dobbs case.
Well, Tony, first off, I have to disclaim your slander of me as having a lawyer hat. It's been 15 years since I practiced law, and I've been clean ever since, and I don't want to have a relapse.
So you're a recovering lawyer.
I'm a recovering lawyer. I was such a good lawyer, okay. Tony, I had to leave the law practice and go be an infantryman. But I listened to the oral arguments, as so many did today, and I caveat everything I say with it's always hard to read the tea leaves from an oral argument when justices might often be playing devil's advocate. But what I heard today I found pretty reassuring. It did not sound like any of these justices are looking for an escape hatch to dismiss the Mississippi case on procedural grounds. I'd say at least four, if not five, of the justices were prepared to face squarely the wrong ruling that the court issued in 1973 in Roe v. Wade. They weren't looking for half measures to find some way to uphold the Mississippi law, but also uphold the Roe and Casey line of cases. I thought some of the questions were extremely penetrating, and the pro-abortion side had no defense for them. Consider Justice Kavanaugh's questions about all of the precedents the court has overturned in its history, and why is it that Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey would be any different from those? I mean, just consider, Tony, from the modern era of the court. In 1986, in Bowers v. Hardwick, the court upheld a law that criminalized gay conduct. Just 17 years later, in Lawrence v. Texas, they overruled Bowers v. Hardwick. And another 12 years later, they said that the Constitution requires states to recognize gay marriage. So in the span of less than three decades, the court went from saying a state can criminalize gay sexual conduct to that states have to recognize gay marriage. If the court can do that on the gay rights cases, then surely it can also reverse wrongly decided cases like Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. It can't be the case that that stare decisis is a Latin phrase that means only liberal decisions can never be reversed.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. But it seemed like there was a realization. I was talking about this earlier. There seems to be a realization that this is going down. So Justice Sotomayor was trying to attach Roe v. Wade to those other cases that you made reference to, Lawrence and Obergefell, trying to somehow say, well, if this goes, those could go too. I think there's an understanding that the left is losing control over the courts, and they've built so much of their policy on judicial fiat rather than the foundation of common law, the natural law. It's just there. It's positive law. They just said it to be so, and so it has been so. But I don't want to spend all my time on that because I want to get to the NDAA. And yesterday, some liberal Democrats joined with the Republicans to block the procedural vote going forward. What's happening with the National Defense Authorization Act?
Well, we refuse to end the debate on this bill, Tony, because Chuck Schumer hasn't allowed sufficient debate and amendments to occur in the first place. Look, the annual defense bill has passed every year for 60 years. It would be total incompetence for Chuck Schumer to have mismanaged this process so badly that he doesn't get it passed this year. Now, to be clear, I also voted against starting debate on this because I don't think this is a good bill that our troops deserve, and it doesn't deliver on what they deserve. However, it's just an example of what a poor floor leader Chuck Schumer has proved to be. I mean, we spent months voting on nominees you've never heard of for offices you didn't know existed when we could have been voting on the defense bill and having votes on all these amendments, like our amendment to strip out the provision that requires women to register for the draft and potentially face draft into combat arms roles, or our amendments to restore the commander's authority in the UCMJ, because I don't believe that our military justice system is systemically racist, as the Democrats would argue. To say nothing of other amendments that deal with core military functions, but Schumer hasn't allowed any of that. That's why we're not finished with this bill yet.
So what's the status? Will we get to this before the end of the year, or are we looking into 2022?
We could start voting as early as tonight, Tony, maybe tomorrow, on some of these amendments, and hopefully we will pass it before Christmas time.
Okay, well, I'm grateful for you standing the ground to clean up this bill, because you're right, it's a bad bill with all of the stuff piled on that the left has put in there. Senator, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, folks, stick with us. Coming up, more on the life issues. We take a look at how far the pro-life community has come and how we still got a ways to go. But there's a reason to be encouraged. We're going to talk about that next with Brent Kylan. Vice President of FRC Action here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Every Wednesday, FRC and FRC Action President Tony Perkins hosts the Pray, Vote, Stand broadcast to equip you to pray, vote, and stand for biblical truth. This weekly half-hour program features experts, elected leaders, and Christian leaders who help you see through the fog that's being created by the biased lenses of the mainstream media. To watch this broadcast, visit PrayVoteStand.org. That's PrayVoteStand.org.
Perkins, and you're listening to Washington Watch, the website tonyperkins.com. We're going to continue our conversation about Roe v. Wade and the Dobbs case that was before the Supreme Court this morning. We're going to continue that conversation into the night. In fact, tonight's edition of Pray, Vote, Stand is going to be focused on this after a half century of the right of this. After a half century, we'll have the opportunity to correct this wrong of Roe v. Wade. Question is this the year? Is this the case? We're going to talk about that tonight. We're going to be joined by ADF attorney Erin Hawley, who actually happens to be the wife of Senator Josh Hawley. Mary Sock will be joining us. We just heard from her earlier. And David Clawson. That's at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I encourage you to tune in for Pray, Vote, Stand, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, PrayVoteStand.org. Now, it may not be clear how the Supreme Court will rule after today's oral arguments in this major abortion case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, but one thing is clear. The pro-life movement has come a long way since the infamous 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion on demand through all 9 months of pregnancy. And it is largely because of dedicated men and women who have refused to back down and have tirelessly committed themselves to speaking up for and defending the unborn. Joining me now to talk about this and how we got to this point today is Brent Kylan, Vice President of FRC Action. Brent Kylan, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
I was just thinking about this as I was talking earlier with Senator Cotton. This thought came to mind when we were discussing the impact that the pro-life community has had on politics. I mean, I think of Senator Cotton. I think of the number of pro-life senators that we have and the fact that today every member of the Republican House in the House on the Republican side of the House is pro-life or at least states a position of pro-life. We've come a long way.
Tony, we really have. And, you know, as we have been involved, America really has become more pro-life. And the progress, as you pointed out earlier, we've got a long ways to go, but the progress really is undeniable. And millions of people committed on this issue who have demonstrated courage and persistence, having those conversations with friends and neighbors and family and winning hearts and minds. And Tony, I think to put this in perspective, it's something when you think about the fact that, you know, almost 50 years ago when we received the Roe v. Wade ruling, we didn't really have a pro-life movement, not in the sense of the pro-life movement that we have today. It took a while to put that together. In some cases, with some groups, it took years for people to know, how do we respond to this? What do we do? How do we organize? And it took a long time to build that infrastructure, but we are seeing the fruit of it now. As you mentioned, Tony, with these elected leaders, I think there's a number of key factors that play into this. The role of the state legislatures has been huge. The role of good judges has been huge. And then, you know, one of these outcomes is the fact that the pro-life position is now mainstream within the Republican Party. That was not always the case. Not that long ago, actually, high-level officials, establishment Republicans would ignore the issue, downplay it, and sometimes actually undermine it. So we really have come a very long way in the defense of the unborn.
No question about that. I've seen that even in my time in the political arena. Back to when I was first elected, having a pro-life position was not mainstream within the Republican Party. There was a lot of pro-choice Republicans. That is not the case. In fact, in the last presidential in the 2016 Republican primary. 17 candidates, only one had a stated position of being pro-choice. So clearly you're right. But also we've seen at the state level, you mentioned those state legislators that have been elected because of pro-life activists, and many of them are pro-life. But we've seen a record number of pro-life laws that have been passed in the last decade alone.
Tony, we have. And again, to put this in perspective, you know, Roe v. Wade been around for about 50 years, but half of the pro-life legislation that has actually been enacted since Roe v. Wade, half of that has come in just the last 10 years, which is some incredible momentum on behalf of life. That's amounted to 580 pro-life bills being passed at the state level, not just introduced, but actually passed at the state level over the past 10 years. And those are the types of laws that have put the pressure on the courts to have to take take these cases up, like we're seeing today with Dobbs, saying, you know, these are laws in defense of life. We're going to protect life at every chance we get. And it really is making an impact. And I think it also points to the importance of those local races. You know, oftentimes those are overlooked. The federal races, the presidential race get most of the focus, but and those are obviously incredibly important, but the state level is really where we've been able to move and advance the ball down the field on behalf of life over the last 10 years, and it's again, it's truly making an impact there.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the scripture, do not grow weary in well-doing, for in due season,
that's right,
we will reap. And I think this is it. And we got to continue to pray, continue to work. There's a lot more work to be done. In fact, if Roe v. Wade is overturned and this issue goes back to the states, there'll be a lot more work for Christians and pro-life Americans to do. Brent Kylan, thanks so much for joining us. Always great to talk with you.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us. I look forward to having you back here again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.